Chapter 15, and I think we got a video to start things off here. It's not a Bible Project video, so if you know, forgive the poor artistry here, but a great message, so let's run that.
Dude.
Hey, what's up?
What you reading?
The Bible.
You're reading the Bible?
Yeah.
Dude, why are you reading the Bible? For class?
No, I just...
Okay, so you're just reading the Bible. You're just sitting here in a coffee shop in the 21st century using state-of-the-art technology to read ancient myths for no reason whatsoever.
Well...
Tell me something. Are you one of those super religious people who thinks Jesus actually rose from the dead?
Well, I do believe that.
Do you also believe in the Easter Bunny? Santa Claus? Unicorns? Bigfoot? Ever been abducted by aliens? And do you buy into all those other ancient myths about dying and rising gods invented by primitive nomadic tribes back in the Bronze Age?
No.
Okay, so what's the difference between Jesus rising from the dead and all those other fairy tales?
Here's the difference. My belief in the resurrection of Jesus is rational. It's based on historical facts.
Facts? What facts?
Well, first, Jesus died by crucifixion.
Whoa, hold on. We don't even know if Jesus existed. Why should I believe your facts?
Well, because the five facts I'm going to give you are backed by so much historical evidence that most professional critical scholars who study the subject accept them as true. That includes skeptical atheist scholars.
Okay, so Jesus was a guy who actually existed and then got himself killed. So what?
That's the first fact. Second, his disciples were convinced that he rose from the dead and appeared to them. Third, Paul, a sworn enemy of the early Christians, suddenly became a Christian. Fourth, Jesus' skeptical brother James also became a Christian. And fifth, the tomb where they put Jesus' body was empty.
And those are well-established historical facts.
Right, but you can't just leave it there. These facts demand an explanation. Otherwise, you've got a big hole in human history.
Okay, here's an explanation. They all lied. It was a conspiracy. The most monumental prank ever perpetrated. His followers stole his corpse from the tomb and then started telling everybody he was alive.
That's the conspiracy theory. The problem is it doesn't explain the facts. How do a few spineless fishermen, cringing in fear for their lives, subdue a bunch of well-armed, professional Roman guards, roll away a 2-ton stone, steal a body, then hide it from a city swarming with people trying to find it? And why would they do it? The disciples had absolutely nothing to gain by lying about Jesus' resurrection. In fact, they were persecuted. And we have good historical evidence that five of them were martyred because of their claim that Jesus rose from the dead. Apparently, not a single one of them ever recanted. People don't willingly die for something they know isn't true. They were there. They knew whether it was true or not.
All right, another theory. The disciples thought they saw Jesus alive after he died, but it was just wishful thinking. They were stressed and just kind of hallucinated.
The hallucination theory also lacks explanatory power. 500 witnesses saw Jesus at the same time, and the disciples touched him. Psychologists have shown that hallucinations don't work like that, nor does this explain the empty tomb.
Okay, look, maybe there's some other explanation, but the bottom line is dead people stay dead. Rising from the dead would be a supernatural event, a miracle, and science has proven that miracles don't happen.
Oh, really? When did that happen?
I don't know. I just kind of heard it somewhere.
Science has not disproven miracles. In fact, that would be impossible.
Why?
Science deals exclusively with natural phenomena, physical matter and material processes, right?
Yeah.
But a miracle, by definition, is not a natural phenomenon. It's supernatural.
So?
So a supernatural event would lie outside the boundaries of science. It's logically impossible for science to throw out any hypothesis that lies outside its boundaries.
Why have I never heard this stuff before?
I don't know. Maybe because it's scary?
Scary?
Yeah. As long as Jesus rising from the dead is just a fairy tale, like Santa Claus and unicorns, it doesn't threaten my little world. But if it's a fact, if he actually did rise from the dead, that's huge. It's a total game changer. And that's why it's so hard to think about it objectively.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Big whoa.
And he's still appearing. he still appears to people. We think that 1 Corinthians 15, that's it, that's the last. You know, once he appeared to Paul, then he stopped appearing to people. But it's simply not the case. Dr. Philip Weeb, a philosophy professor at Trinity Western, I was sitting in his class, and Dr. Weeb began to recount a story that had happened in his church just a couple of years before. And he said, all of a sudden, during the midst of their worship service, Jesus appeared in the back corner of the sanctuary, the front corner of the sanctuary, and the entire congregation saw Jesus. I'm sitting in my classroom, and I'm going, wait a minute, this is not my biblical studies or religious studies professor. This is my philosophy professor telling me that he has seen Jesus. Because of that encounter, Dr. Weeb began to research sightings of Jesus, people who had seen Jesus, groups that had seen Jesus, and he picked out, 30 different things from post-New Testament to modern day, 30 incidences that he felt he could do a significant study on each one, and wrote a book about it. If you're interested, the book is Visions of Jesus, Direct Encounters from the New Testament to Today. People are still seeing Jesus. Then we have the modern phenomena that is occurring all throughout the Muslim world in the Middle East. They're seeing Jesus. Some of them don't even know who he is, but they have this encounter with Jesus, and they begin describing him to somebody else, and they go, oh, that's Jesus. It's changing people's lives in a dramatic way. I believe these miracles, these sightings of Jesus, are more common than they may seem. You may have had a moment where you saw Jesus. I don't know. And if you told me that you had, I have no reason not to believe you. Jesus still appears to people. He's alive. Why couldn't he? Why couldn't he appear anytime he wanted to people? He appeared in the Old Testament. We have several encounters where we are certain that the person that they're talking about is the pre-incarnate Jesus. Why not post-New Testament? The resurrection of Jesus is at the very heart of the gospel that Paul is talking about here in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Let me read for you verses 6 through 11. It says, after that he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me also as to one abnormally born. For I am the least of the apostles, and do not even deserve to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God. But by the grace of God, I am what I am. And his grace to me was not without effect. No, I worked harder than all of them. Not I, but the grace of God that was with me. Whether then it was I or they, this is what we preach. And this is what you believed. So we have these other appearances. He appears to 500 people at once. Is there a case to be made for hallucination? Yeah, sure, you could make a case for mass hallucination. It's happened before, right? We have all different kinds of mass hallucinations or so-called hallucinations. In fact, if we believe in miracles, they may not be hallucinations at all. They may have really happened. But we have all of these instances where people have mass hallucinations, where some shrine begins to of a saint, or Jesus begins to weep, or there is an icon of some sort that begins to bleed, or there's sightings of Mary that have taken place all throughout the world for millennia now. People are still seeing Mary in just about everything. But these mass hallucinations are always confined to a location, a physical phenomena of some sort, a shrine, an icon, and they occur at a point in time. Jesus appeared in many locations. He was a real physical manifestation that moved and lived. They touched him. They watched him eat. He prepared food for them. They heard him, and he ate with them. So it doesn't fit any of the other categories where we psychologists have attempted to explain some sort of mass hallucination. It defies all logic. And then it says, after he appeared to 500, he appeared to James. James, the stepbrother of Jesus, right? James, as far as we know up to this point, is not a believer. He was skeptical. In fact, the only account we see of him in the New Testament and any of the Gospels is him coming with his brothers and his mom to kind of collect him because they think he's crazy. And so Jesus has this appearance to James. It's not recorded any other place except right here. We don't know anything about this encounter that he had, but it was a personal encounter with his brother, singled out probably because he was a brother. Also, James became a leader in the Jerusalem church, and so probably singled out for that reason as well. I wonder what that meeting was like. Right? You've got like this brother, you've grown up with him. At one point you think he's crazy, and then you're devastated because they kill him. And all of a sudden, the real resurrected brother comes to you. Well, kind of like my brother Tim. All of a sudden, Jesus is standing there before James, and what can he do with this? Everything that Jesus had said about himself became true in that moment. And James is changed forever, and writes one of the great letters in the New Testament and becomes a profound leader in the New Testament church. I would have loved to have been there. At that particular meeting, this reunion of these two brothers who probably loved each other deeply. And he then also mentions the appearance to the apostles, probably referring back to Acts chapter 1 when Jesus meets them in Galilee, and then there's the ascension. There is a distinction between the 12, which were mentioned earlier, right? He says he appeared to the 12, blah, 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 and now he appears to the apostles. They're two different groups, right? You all understand that the apostles and the disciples are two different groups. We know that James and Paul were considered apostles, but they were not disciples. We know that Judas was a disciple, but he was not an apostle. So there's a crossover between these two groups, but they are not the same, and that's probably why we have mention of the 12 initially, and then in this time in Galilee when they see the apostles. And then Paul lists himself in the verses 8 and 9. He lists himself last, probably referring to his meeting with Jesus on the road to Damascus. The language he uses here in the Greek stresses an objective sighting of Jesus as opposed to a vision. So it was a real manifestation. He did not lapse into some kind of stupor and have a vision. He didn't fall asleep and have a dream. The language that he uses in the Greek is that he saw a real Jesus and had this encounter with the glorified Jesus. We also know although we don't think he's talking about this, but we also have Paul's account of being caught up into heaven and where he has this time with Jesus. We don't know how long he was there. We don't know what happens. Paul says it's this indescribable time that he spent with Jesus in heaven, but he has this moment, which is unique to all of the other apostles, and has another meeting with Jesus. In every case, these appearances are a testimony to the real resurrection of Jesus, and in each case, his appearance to them was life-changing. These men had their lives changed by the appearance of Jesus. I don't know what would have happened to the disciples had Jesus not appeared to them. But I know because he appeared to them, they were changed. They went from fear to courage. James went from skeptical to a believer. Paul went from a persecutor to a follower. Every single one of them who had this moment with Jesus was changed forever and for good. Well, Paul goes on in verses 10 to 11, and he places himself on an equal footing with the other apostles. Paul gets shortchanged frequently in the New Testament because he was not one of the 12. I think James gets a pass because he was Jesus' brother, and so he spent lots of time with Jesus. Paul is this afterthought. And as a result of it, there were certain people, probably in the Corinthian church, who downplayed his apostleship. And so Paul is constantly having to literally prop himself up from time to time with people who doubted him. But here he places himself on an equal footing with the apostle. He says, I'm the least of the apostles and don't deserve to be called an apostle because I persecuted the church, but I worked harder than all of them. So there's this strange mixture of humility and pride. And yet the pride is mitigated by these three mentions of grace, right? You know, not I, but the grace of God. I worked harder than all of them, but it wasn't me. It was grace of God working through me. And so he's trying in the best way he can to say, I've been given this position by God. It was his grace. I didn't deserve it, but nobody did. The apostles, other apostles, they didn't deserve it as well. This is a work, an act of grace. Three times he mentions his dependence on God's grace. It is this grace that precedes any good that he has done. And by that grace, he has worked harder than all the other apostles. I don't know what he did that was so much greater than them. Most of them stayed in Jerusalem, didn't do the traveling, so he did great missionary work. He planted churches virtually everywhere he went. I think because he was single, he had more time and dedication. He was able to be mobile and move about and plant churches. He was willing to forgo a lot of the privileges of apostleship in order to continue the work. But so maybe he's not bragging. Maybe he's just stating the facts. I don't know. But he says it's because of this grace that he's able to do any of it. The central point is that they all agree. This is the same gospel. Every single one of all the apostles. This is the gospel that we preach. And this whole thing with grace and Paul is part of this doctrine of concurrence that we keep talking about, right? Concurrence. God and us. God and us. We participate. We are not people who just sit and absorb the grace of God, and as a result of that, we go, we're just kind of moved along to do great things, kind of like machines, and God is programming us. It doesn't work that way. We participate in this, and by the grace of God, we work hard. There's hard work to be done. And you go, well, he hasn't demanded that out of me, he's not asking me to do these things. Yes, he is. You've not gotten off the hook. You're not, well, I'm not the Apostle Paul, Then who are you? Do you know who you are? Is the grace of God at work in your life? Paul was the least of the apostles. You've got to be in a far better position than Paul, right? Were you a persecutor of the church? Were you putting Christians to death? Were you putting them in prison? You've already got a leg up. Were you raised in the church? My goodness, do you listen to incredible preaching every Sunday? Well, some Sundays. It's this participation, this working with God, doing things that are far, far beyond our capacity. And if you don't believe that, or if you practically don't believe that because you're not participating in this grace, this outpouring of His grace in your life for you to do great and miraculous things, then you fail to understand the power of the resurrection and the foundation of the gospel. It's at the heart of what they all preach. It's what they believed. And now it's what we believe. Right? This is what we believe, right? We believe Jesus really rose from the dead. And because of that, everything has changed. We have power to do things far beyond our capacity or our ability. You. Apostle Paul-like stuff. Have that capacity. As you participate in the grace that he pours out in your life. Well, a couple things for you to think about. We are part of this testimony to the resurrection. We are with them. We're part of this ongoing testimony to the resurrection. Just as they passed on this story and testified to his appearance, we pass it on as well. People have seen Jesus. You've experienced Jesus. A real experience. A life-changing experience. And as they shared the story of their changed life, we add ours to the countless stories of people whose lives have been changed by Jesus Christ. If somehow you prayed a prayer or you came forward and your life is not changed, then you missed something. Something's wrong, because for the person who comes to Jesus, their lives are changed. You cannot have an experience of Jesus without a changed life. Period. Exclamation point. It doesn't happen. A changed life is the natural byproduct of having this moment with Jesus. And we join with all of them. All of these stories, countless, countless stories through the millennia of people whose lives have been dramatically changed. Every nation, every walk of life, every color and shape of person you can imagine, people deep, deep in their sin, and others who seemed to live a glorious life and then came to Jesus and their life was changed anyway. All kinds of people, all through the ages, this grace is no respecter of persons, poor people and middle class people and rich people. All of them come into Jesus and they all have this singular experience of God changing them completely. And we're a part of that. If your life is not changed, it's not too late. Or maybe it had a little change, but it's time for a big change. Maybe you're one of those typical American Christians who always keep Jesus out here. Our greatest fear in the church, as we've said before, is intimacy with God, and so we keep him out here. I don't want him to get too close. I just want enough of God to get in. I just want heaven. If he would just leave me alone right now so that I can live my life the way I want to and then let me into heaven, that would be the perfect scenario, right? Does that sound good to you? If it does, then you don't understand the gospel that they're talking about here. If that sounds okay, you don't understand the power of the resurrection. You don't understand why these people here whose lives were changed were willing to lay them down for Jesus, joyfully lay them down for Jesus. It was not a sacrifice to them to give up their lives. The passage that Bob read this morning, the guy who finds the pearl of great price, you know who that is, right? That's Jesus. And once you understand his value and his worth, everything pales in comparison, even our own lives. And so that grace then comes in and we begin to participate in that grace with God, and we start doing things we never would have dreamed we could do. Changed life. So I got two questions for you this morning. Real answers. This is open forum time. First, how has grace touched your life? How has the grace of God touched your life today? Not like today, currently. Do you know? Okay, let's hear it. I just want to hear one or two things. Forgiveness. Okay, that's a big deal. Because apart from forgiveness, what is my destiny? Death, the second death for eternity, all time, no hope of return. Forgiveness is a big deal. Okay, so there we go. There's one. Protection from? Yeah, for a time anyway. Right, we begin to understand what real life looks like. And we now have the capacity to say yes to Jesus. Whereas prior to him, all we can do is do what we want, which frequently gets us in trouble. What else? Unconditional love. Okay? Hope. Peace. I'll never leave you or forsake you. Love. The air that you breathe. The food that you eat. The blood that courses through your veins. The body that you have, as frail as it may be. All gifts of God's grace. A mind to understand the truth of Scripture. Do you get any direction from God? And what about those moments where the word doesn't apply, but all of a sudden you know you have this peace going, this is the right thing. I know this is right. You have the Holy Spirit to bear witness to you about things in your life. How much grace gets poured out into your life each and every day? How many of you have taken the grace of God for granted? Yeah, you better all raise your hands, okay? Because I know that that's true. I know it's true because we don't even understand how great His grace is. How do you expect, second question, how do you expect that grace to touch your life in the future? Harder question. What's that again? That He will keep us. Yes, He will keep us in relationship with Him, okay? Yeah, I don't want to stay the same. If I'm receiving massive amounts of grace, there should be massive amounts of grace flowing through me. I cannot contain the grace of God. I ought not to try to dam it up. I have the hope of heaven. I have the hope of transformation. I have the hope of eternity with the one who loves me. Great. Guess what? Some of the most difficult times of your life may not have come yet. But there's grace for those moments. Some of the most joyous times of your life haven't come yet. And there's grace for those moments. Because the joys can take you from Him just as much as the sorrow can. We are debtors in an incredible way to God's grace. It's all rooted in the resurrection of Christ. This thing that they started preaching immediately upon the death and resurrection of Jesus, that they've been preaching and we've been passing along to each other for 2,000 plus years. It's never going to stop. You cannot stop it. They attempt to stop it from time to time. And they may have stamped it out in a village here or a family there, but this grace continues to be poured out and lives continue to be changed and governments can't put a halt to it. They're trying their hardest in China. They're trying in other nations to stamp out the spread of the Word of God, the gospel, but it is absolutely infection. It has the coronavirus beat in exponentially. Are you afraid of the coronavirus? Because we have grace. If the Lord wants to take me with the coronavirus, He's going to take me with the coronavirus. If I'm going to get hit by a bus, I'm going to get hit by a bus. I can live in the grace of God, knowing that He will keep me and He will use me, that I am immortal until the day He calls me home. Yeah. So I want to prepare you for tonight. First, please come. it will be a service unlike any you may have ever been to. It'll be